Welcome to the History of Networking, where we drag all the skeletons out of the wiring closet and ponder the ghosts of protocols past. Today, we are talking to Jen Rexford about the history of programmable networks. So grab a pile of cookies, settle in, and listen as we meld with the finest minds in networking.
I'll just 3, 2, 1 in. And by the way, I'm going to start a timer, not to keep track of time, but primarily. So if at some point you say, oh, I really shouldn't have said that, or really, can we cut that out?
Yeah.
I'll flag it on my little timer thing. And then I'll know to go back and look for that when I go through and edit this. My wife does a lot of the editing on this, so it's good for her to have a little thing saying, please look at 15 minutes and 30 seconds or whatever it is. And, you know, take a poke at that and make sure that should come out or whatever. It just makes it easier to do that kind of stuff. So, yeah, great. All right, 3, 2, 1. Well, hello, Donald, and hello, Jen. First time for Jen on the History of Networking. Of course, that's kind of the nature of History of Networking. Donald's at home with guitars, and Jen looks like she's at home with books. I mean, I don't know, to each their own. So Jen is part of our special series that's come out of the Association of Computing Machinery. And I'll just say, as I always say, whenever I point people to articles in ACM, if you're not a member of the SIGCOM, you should be. It's a great resource for networking research and to keep up with that side of the world. I do try to review papers from there on my blog from time to time, but you should really just join and latch on to that research because it's really good for network engineers to know that stuff. So Jen, I guess we should just start right in. So where or how did you get involved with programmable networks to start with? And let's just back into the history of that a little bit.
You bet. So when I went to graduate school, I started grad school in 1991, and I was interested in parallel computing. So I wasn't involved in computer networking. I like to joke to my students, I never took a networking course, but now I teach them. And I was really interested in parallel computing, and in particular, how to harness the power of multiple computers to work together on a single problem. And getting them to communicate efficiently was an important part of that. And so the group I was in was really interested in, depending on what kind of application those machines are cooperating on, you might want them to route or do flow control differently. If you're doing a fast Fourier transform, you might do one thing for those nodes to communicate. If you're doing matrix computation, you might do something else. And so we started looking at having programmable routing inside a parallel machine. And that was fun, but towards the end of grad school, all the parallel computing companies went bankrupt. Which gave me pause. And I think, you know, the bottom line was that I think at the time we thought Moore's Law was over and that
they all went bankrupt. That's a pretty good sign.
Yeah, I have a sort of collection of mugs of now defunct parallel computing companies, and I sort of pay homage to them periodically just to remember my failures. So, and the problem there was really two things. One was Moore's Law wasn't over, right? So single processors were continuing to get fast. And so no matter how clever you were in getting multiple machines to work together, you were always a generation of silicon behind. And the second was actually, frankly, the networking was the hard part of getting parallel machines to work. It was really getting finding the right applications that were amenable to parallelization. And so in the end, I sort of felt that that wasn't a good idea. And then ATM switching was becoming common right around my last couple years of grad school. And I thought, oh, ATM switches are kind of like multi-computer routers. That's interesting. That's a great segue for me from, you know, now, and the internet was taking off. I'm like, wow, there seems to be real data, real applications, real users, real software, real hardware. That would be a great segue to make. And so I spent some time as an intern at AT&T and later joined AT&T. And I said, great, ATM, yay. That's what I'm going to work on.
You're giving me nightmares.
Yeah. So I want to make sure that your audience has tremendous confidence in me and my judgment early in the call. So I worked on ATM scheduling and ATM PNNI routing. And then, gosh, these things have to carry something. So IP over ATM. And then I decided that maybe IP not over ATM would be a more interesting area of work. And that's what I've been doing ever since. But the reason I mentioned that is that there were a couple of things about ATM networking that are interesting. One was I realized actually getting measurement data from operational networks, even working at AT&T, to evaluate my ideas was hard. That people didn't actually have topology, routing, and traffic data, which I needed even just to do experiments with speculative network architecture. And I thought, oh, maybe there's something interesting about measuring operational networks. It's not just some data I'm unable to get. Maybe there's actually technical challenges there. And IP over ATM had this idea of grouping a set of packets together to be handled by a single set of data plane state in the switch, a circuit or virtual circuit in the case of ATM. But those ideas are very similar to what came later in OpenFlow. So even though that wasn't, you know, this quite the same thing as programmable networking, it got me thinking in that direction. In the meantime, in the academic community, a lot of academics, while I was working at AT&T, were thinking about active networks. And so programmability was there for sure. There was a lot of interest in packets carrying code and being able to innovate inside the network in a way that the modern internet was already starting to preclude. And I thought my colleagues were off base there because it wasn't really clear who this programmer was that was going to put code into packets. And it didn't perform well. It kind of reminded me of my thesis, something really flexible that doesn't perform well. And so I was somewhat of a skeptic on active networks and didn't work in it myself. And I began to think maybe the programmer should be the network administrator, not the end user. And maybe the program should be helping them do traffic engineering and planned maintenance and attack mitigation and measuring the traffic matrix and DDoS detection and so on. So this interest in programmability and this interest in network management came together, and I thought actually a programmable control plane is more interesting than a programmable data plane. And in particular, we did a lot of work at AT&T with the network administrators on things like traffic engineering, configuration checking, and so on, where we started to understand a lot more of the day-to-day of how they were running the network, holding it together with duct tape and so on. And I had a whole new respect for the fact that we talk about the internet being simple, that IP is, dumb core and everything is so simple, but really the inside of the network was anything but, if you looked at the control plane software and the management software and practices to manage it. I thought, oh, this is where the code needs to be better.
Yeah, in fact, we really haven't solved the problem of measuring the network to this day. Honestly,
exactly.
It's completely. When I worked on large scale networks, and even where I work now, it still is a constant issue. Like, you can't figure out what's going on. Dave Myers brought this up as a problem for artificial intelligence and networking. Like, we can't. How are we going to do AI and networking if we can't measure anything and get it into a format where AI can consume it?
Exactly. And even the measurements we are able to do often involve a tremendous amount of inference, right? We get 5-minute snapshots of link utilization, and we're trying to figure out where the short-term congestion was that caused a video glitch. So we still have these tremendous gaps between what we're able to collect and what we want to know. So I started thinking a little more about network management software. First, how do I help network administrators tune the configuration of the protocols we have? And then later thinking, gee, it'd be nice if we could actually tell the routers directly what to do. Because it's a lot of work to model OSPF, model BGP, model everything, and then try to back out of that how it should be configured to behave the way you wish it would. Instead, it became appealing to say, gee, can't we just tell the network what the answer is rather than trying to coax it into getting to the answer we already know we want? And at that time, a colleague of mine at AT&T came to me and said, by the way, back in the 80s, there was this thing called the network control point in the phone network. And I started to roll my eyes like, oh, it's another bellhead, but who has a story about how the phone network had it better and we internet people should, grow up and all that. And so I was skeptical at first, but I went back and read the papers, and they basically said, gee, logically centralized control with a stored program computer telling the individual phone switches what to do would be a better solution for extensibility and performance. So I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting, actually. And then I thought, what would that be for routing in the internet as opposed to in the phone network? And it could be some sort of BGP route server that tells the routers underneath how to route. And so we started working on that at AT&T and built a thing called the routing control platform that was sort of like a glorified route reflector, but it took in all the inputs from neighboring domains and applied more sophisticated policies to do things like block DOS attacks or do planned maintenance and so on. So it became essentially a route server plus plus. That was think of it as sort of a poor man's software-defined network, where instead of speaking OpenFlow or P4 or whatever the interface du jour is, it's just speaking BGP to the routers and shoving the route down their throats that you want them to use. And that was the next thing I did.
Yeah, it's actually interesting because that's still in use today. by the way, by a lot of providers, not necessarily that particular system, but a lot of hyperscalers still today use BGP as their southbound control plane. And they're looking at things like BGPLS as a southbound control plane to shove information, link state type information into their databases to do that type of routing. It's pretty interesting that that's still an active idea that people are using.
Yeah, exactly. And so in a way, you know, this is sort of active networks with a step back. It's saying the programmer is the network administrator, not the end user. You're programming the control plane, not the data plane. And a focus very specifically on ISP network management. And then Hui Zhang, who's a professor at Carnegie Mellon, came on sabbatical and he said, oh, this stuff's cool, but you keep apologizing like you're only doing it this way because Cisco and Juniper won't let you change the code on the boxes, which was also true and infuriating. And he said, you know, this might be the right thing to do even if you could change the code. Maybe doing things a little more centrally is not a bad idea. And so we started thinking more broadly about what an architecture would look like that separated decision-making from the dissemination of the decision to the network elements and the discovery of the measurement data you need to make good decisions. And then finally, of course, the data plane has to be distributed in the network elements. And so we started thinking about that. We called it the 4D architecture for decision, disseminate, discovery, and data. And it was kind of a high-level idea, but the idea was maybe there were applications beyond ISPs and routing. Maybe BGP isn't the ideal dissemination protocol. It was just expedient, but maybe there was something better to do. And that was sort of where I was at when I left AT&T to come to Princeton, ready to stop thinking just about ISPs and just about BGP, but not yet sure exactly how general the ideas might be.
So, yeah, interesting. So, yeah, I mean, I often say that BGP is overused for a lot of things. Like I was telling you before we started recording that I have been trying to get people to stop using BGP on data center fabrics. And I just think that this idea of using BGP as a southbound is just you're pushing a lot of information into a single app, into a single control plane. And maybe it's not so good to do that. So when you came to Princeton, you were thinking along those lines. So where did you go from there? How did you?
Yeah, so a couple things happened right around the time I came to Princeton. One was my colleague, Larry Peterson at Princeton, was building a system called Planet Lab. And what I found exciting about that is in leaving industry, I was worried I was going to lose touch with my ability to build and deploy real systems, which is one of the things I loved about working at AT&T. And here I saw a colleague that was creating infrastructure. And I thought, oh, this is great. But he's focusing on distributed systems, and I'm more of a networking person. So what would be sort of the underlying network hardware I would need to do the kind of work I wanted to do? And then at Stanford, Martin Casado and Nick McEwen and others were working on the Ethane project, and then later the OpenFlow ideas. And I started getting involved a little later when OpenFlow was being conceived. And I thought, this is great. Now we can actually define the interface we want, not use the interface we have. And a direct interface to the data plane like OpenFlow rather than, or forces or things of that ilk that were, you know, in the air at the time, rather than shoehorning BGP. Because I mean, I completely agree with you, BGP is being abused in all sorts of ways. And in fact, my long-term goal is BGP is not in the internet by the time I die.
I don't believe that's going to happen.
Well, if I have to live,
unless you're like planning to live to like 200.
Exactly. If I have to live a very long time, it's a give up on the internet. But clearly BGP, like you were saying, Russ, I mean, it's not the right shoehorn, and it was expedient that we used it at the time we did, but it was by no means a principled choice at all. And OpenFlow has its limitations too, and I'll get to that, but OpenFlow is at least saying, here's what the chips do in the data plane. Let's at least have an open API there. And what was cool about that was a lot of network marketing terms, router, switch, firewall, NAT, and so on, all really fit that simple match action processing model that OpenFlow exposed, where you match on a subset of bits in the packet header and take a simple packet level action on packets that match that particular pattern. And so it was a nice way to generalize networking, and for me, a nice way to explain some basic networking functionality to non-networking people, who are frankly normally glaze over when the 3 and 4 letter acronyms come out. And so it was useful for me both in sharpening my own thinking and having something I could actually build systems on top of, but it also let me talk to colleagues, particularly in programming languages, who frankly would have gone running for the hills if I tried to explain BGP to them. And so that was sort of the next phase for me, was starting to think, hey, if I think networks should be programmable, maybe I should talk to people who actually know how to design programming languages.
Okay, well, that's cool. So you moved to the other side of things, working out of the control plane back towards programming, or back towards the programming language side of things. And I think that this is really important in the way people work as engineers and researchers and stuff like that is just that we often want to get deeper and deeper. I'm doing my PhD right now. And one thing that one of the people I'm working with says is, you know, part of the point of doing a dissertation is to go dive deeper and come up drier than anybody else ever has. Because after all, you don't want to actually learn anything in this process. It's so narrow that you'll never do anything with it. But I think that that concept of moving sideways and figuring out adjacent areas and picking up things is really important.
Yeah, and that's the thing I've been fortunate throughout my career. I've really enjoyed rubbing up against neighboring disciplines, and it's been either, you know, computer architecture in terms of what the hardware can give me, or programming languages about how to specify what we want. Or, you know, sort of algorithms and data structures to say how far can we get despite the fact that the hardware is limited. And so there's always been some other area. I mean, networking, frankly, I don't really think of it as a discipline in its own right. I think of it as a messy domain of really interesting problems to work on. And domain knowledge of networking is useful. I mean, I think that is a thing. But if it's not obvious to me that it has its own pedagogy or its own intellectual contribution that's completely standalone. I mean, certainly artifacts we build are right. Noteworthy and such, but right. It's not clear to me that the academic study of networking should take place purely among networking people. And that's sort of a recipe for fairly messy things to happen, I think.
Right, yeah. And I think that's a lot of the problem the networking industry has got into right now is that we focus so hard on doing networking as its own thing without thinking about its intersection with other things that we tend to build our own little silo, and we've got to stop doing that if we want to move forward.
So when I started working with my programming languages colleagues, I was still interested in the same question. How do we measure the network, decide what to do, and then update the network to a new configuration, well, hopefully without causing a transient disruption in the process? And so we started working on language abstractions for, you know, query abstractions for asking questions about network traffic, composition abstractions to be able to talk about routing and load balancing and monitoring in modular ways, and then update abstractions to be able to transition the network from one policy to another without breaking things in the process. And so that was really still very much informed by the same kind of control loops I was thinking about at AT&T, measure, analyze, control. And that I never have really gotten away from that. It's just the underlying hardware has gotten better, and the higher level abstractions supporting it have gotten better as my career has gone on. But it's always thinking about that control loop that is done manually by the network administrator or by software written in his or her behalf. And so trying to narrow that gap has always been what I wanted to do. So we did a lot of stuff with OpenFlow and, you know, trying to create interesting applications and interesting abstractions to support them. And then it just, you know, like second system syndrome happened to OpenFlow. Right, OpenFlow 1.0 was pretty elegant but very simplistic, and you couldn't do a lot of interesting things without sending packets to the controller, which is really obviously a bad idea. And so then OpenFlow 1.1 came out, and 1.2, 1.3, and then the spec got bigger, and the number of header fields got larger, and the number of tables got bigger, and all of a sudden it was kind of a monstrosity.
And that's partially, I think, because it went into whatever the organization was that was managing it, right? Open networking or whatever it was.
Right, the Open Networking Foundation, right.
Yeah, and it became it became a camel, right? What always happens with network specs is that you get 500 people in the room and they all have different ideas, and they all have little corner cases they want to solve, and boom, it suddenly becomes 20,000 pages long. And solves everything, but doesn't solve anything.
Exactly. And that's a piece of it. And I think a second piece was, as people started to try to build real applications, the simpler and more elegant versions of OpenFlow just weren't up to the task. And right. So there was a need for more sophistication, you know, but it wasn't clear what form it should take. And more of the same, more tables, more headers, more actions, more pages of spec, if you will, wasn't heading in a good direction. And so a bunch of us, Nick McEwen, myself and others, were like, okay, this is never going to stop. You know, we clearly have to just put on the brakes. And thinking about programmable data planes became a more natural way to think about it. So a lot of people, Nick McEwen and others, started working on reconfigurable match action processing hardware that later became the basis of Barefoot Networks. And I wasn't involved in that work at all. I was just an observer. But I thought, this is great. This is a performance-first version of active networks. Put in the data plane that which you can without compromising speed and without compromising chip area. And put as much programmability as you can that's targeted, understanding that it's going to not be a general purpose Turing complete machine. you know, put in a parser, put in arithmetic logic units, put in some state, put in some tables. And that became an eye-opener for now we can do stuff in the data plane that OpenFlow made us do in the control plane. And so in the last several years now, I've been much more interested in, now that we have this, can we write logically centralized programs? Sure, but compile them to run in a distributed way in the data plane. So a realization I've had recently is, you know, the logically centralized control is just an abstraction. It shouldn't be the reality. That for many things, you really need distributed control for all the reasons we've relied on it for years, that it's scalability and reliability and fate sharing and so on. And yet we still want to be able to specify network policies and objectives in a central way. That doesn't imply that their realization has to be centralized. And likewise, this control loop of measure and then analyze and then control can itself also be embedded in the data plane. It doesn't mean the measurements have to come out of the network and be shaken up in a bag and the answers spit back down. That can be appropriate, but then in a lot of cases, you might want to measure and take action directly where the data are collected. And so for me, this move towards programmable data planes is allowing that to come full circle. Yes, so I still care about the hardware and about the innovation of the network operator, but I don't necessarily view that those things have to take place at different locations in the system.
Okay. So what's the current work in this area? I mean, this sounds vaguely like intent-based networking to some degree, yeah. Although that may be a bad word for some people. And it also sounds vaguely like thinking more. I mean, I do a lot of thinking myself around layering, proper layering, uh-huh. And that we don't layer control planes the way that we should. We layer the data plane and we don't layer the control plane. I don't understand that. Like, we're very unintentional about the control plane layering.
Wouldn't you say that people don't have the ability to do that given current?
Yeah, probably.
That's probably why you can't, there's no one thinks about it because you just can't do that with the Cisco or the Vista.
Right, and it's not a mental mindset either for network designers.
Yeah, I think it's just dwelling for a moment on what Donald just said, actually, because I think all the stories I've been telling have been situations where I was working with a hand tied behind my back. You know, Cisco not letting me change the code, OpenFlow not letting me change the hardware, and the beat goes on. And at one level, without some constraints, you can be very easily unmoored and have difficulty getting anything done. So sometimes those constraints are a blessing in disguise because they at least sharpen your focus on what you can change. But on the flip side, there's a lot of work that never happens because people are skeptical that there's any chance it'll see the light of day. And I think most networking researchers really want to see their ideas used in practice and are quite willing to constrain their thinking based on what they think has a chance of actually getting done. And so I've been finding in my career this a big tension. I call it sort of ambitious pragmatism. I want to get big things done, but I don't want to be so ambitious that I'm not realistic about the chance of things actually getting deployed in practice. And obviously, you can go too far to either of those extremes, and finding the right balance isn't always easy, but that's always been a goal. And I think now we're at a point where maybe one can start to think about the question you asked about, you know, better control plane software architectures and layering. And have a chance for it actually to happen.
So what are you working on now? Is it not, I'm assuming it's not P4 specifically, but something in that realm or something in that area?
Yeah, so I'm really excited about network management, as I have been the whole way. And in particular, network telemetry, where now I think directly in the data plane, we can collect, analyze, and report on, you know, so we can do fine-grained analytics in the data plane. So for example, we've deployed on the Princeton campus, and we've also been working with AT&T on being able to do microburst analytics directly in the data plane. I'd like to know if there is a small timescale burst. SNMP would miss it, but I can, in a programmable data plane, can say this particular set of flows caused a short-term buildup that caused a lot of other traffic to experience loss. And we've deployed something like this on the Princeton campus. We've been able to uncover performance problems that are affecting bulk data transfers for our science departments because we were able to look much more precisely at the queues. So the ability to both collect and analyze the data in the same place means we don't have to make a choice between granularity and overhead. We can reduce the data based on the question we want to ask. More generally, closing the loop to be able to measure and act, I think, will be interesting as well. But often knowing what's going on in the network is harder than knowing what to do about it. And so my focus has been on trying to observe directly and efficiently, despite the limitations of hardware, can't do everything. You know, how can we get a very accurate view of what's going on at a fine grain to diagnose performance and security problems directly in the data plane? So that's a big part of my focus, including deployment efforts with our campus and also with carriers like AT&T.
Ah, so you're actually helping build the Princeton network.
Yeah. So we have a bunch of Barefoot P4 capable switches plugged in on span ports on our border routers. So we're not, you know, right now we're not controlling the network, but we're essentially doing glorified packet monitoring, but doing the analytics directly on the switch that we're tapping with rather than doing packet capture. For two reasons, it's sort of cheaper, right? We're not logging a ton of data. It's also better from a privacy perspective, right? We're not logging stuff we shouldn't be allowed to see. We're shipping code to the box rather than data to the code.
Right, exactly, yeah. So you're kind of beating back the cap theorem a little bit and distributing the database in order to have better accessibility and manage the traffic or manage the data. There was one point we were talking about how routers and switches today actually have a complete internal network that's rather high speed just for shipping telemetry.
Yes.
People don't realize that. There's so much telemetry out there that it's like a big deal.
Exactly. And I've been excited about the deployment on the Princeton campus. I've been working with a bunch of other schools and colleagues to encourage them to do the same in their own campus. Because I think a lot of people, academics, complain, oh, we don't get data sets. We need Google or Facebook or Microsoft to share their data with us. And frankly, I think it's barking up the wrong tree. I mean, sure, it'd be nice. I obviously hope that people share data, but it comes at great cost to companies to do that. And it's often the case that it's better to collect data from the networks that we already have all around us. And any of us that work for a company or a university have an enterprise network. It may not be as glamorous as monitoring the Google network, but it still means we have real data and real problems and real users that can keep us honest about whether we're solving problems that actually matter.
So I have a thing about that because I was an infra architect LinkedIn, and I've worked with Google and all those guys, and I actually don't think their networks are as interesting as people think they are.
What a relief.
I actually think that a lot of enterprise networks have more interesting problems at a smaller scale. The main interesting thing about a large scale network, a hyperscaler, is just simply the scale, right? That's really what's interesting about it, is just how fast can you build a pod? If you can build a data center pod in 3 hours instead of 3 days, that's a huge difference. In enterprise networks, you have a lot more traffic flow. And, you know, you talked about constraints. You're constrained in a normal network by the applications you have to put on the network. You don't have that constraint in a hyperscaler. I can go to the applications developers, put my foot down and say, no, you will not do this, you know? And you can't do that in an enterprise network, so.
Exactly, and in fact, we're a BY, you know, bring your own device campus also. So one of the apps we developed for the campus network administrators is OS fingerprinting. Directly right. In the data plane. So packets coming from people who connect their device on campus, we can tell them what OS they're running by looking at the TCP behavior they exhibit. And likewise, traffic coming to campus, we found cases of cyber attacks of people, you know, we can tell from what OS they're running that they're doing something sketchy, or we can tell that they're spoofing what OS, you know, they're obfuscating in some way what OS they're running. And so that's been a kind of fun set of challenges that would never really exist in a data center setting where, of course, you know what OS you're running.
Yeah.
And any OS should be, or it's a, you know, your customers are running a VM, you know, that with a particular OS, but it's a very different environment. And the big data science transfers that go on campus, their performance really matters, and they're an unusual workload that isn't as widely studied, but it gives us plenty of fodder for our students to think about interesting things.
Yeah. So going back through all of this, I mean, are there specific lessons you've learned that you think are good for even the average network engineer or researcher? Or, I mean, assuming that some college students that are studying network engineering are going to listen to this. I know some colleges that give these podcasts as listening assignments, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think the first, I think, was keeping it real. I mean, I think the places where I made mistakes in my career and worked on the wrong problem, it was when I was too divorced from the user or the application. And convinced myself that the technical problem was interesting, like, you know, customized routing on a multi-computer when Moore's Law wasn't over. And writing applications to run on parallel machines was much harder than that problem that I thought I would be induced by those applications. So I think finding compelling use cases, finding people in pain. Network administrators are always in pain, so I always like to work on network management because I know there are people with pain. I think a second to me, I mentioned already earlier, is these interdisciplinary collaborations, that if you can talk to these people in other domains, you can tackle much more ambitious problems. And it's also a lot more fun because they don't automatically take at face value that networks should work the way they do. and you have to explain networking to them, and it has to make sense to them, and you want them to respect that the network isn't stupid, so you feel this pressure to explain yourself in a better way than you might if you were talking to someone with groupthink. I would say another is I'm going to sound like an old fogey now, but knowing some history. You know, a lot of these ideas come around the pike many times. We go back and forth between everything should be centralized, everything should be distributed. We should have open APIs to the data plane. That was an idea in Forces and a long time ago. You know, so open and active networks, thought programmable data planes were a good idea. Some of these are approached in different kinds of networks and under different constraints and maybe well before their time. It didn't take off for some legitimate reason, but knowing that history is really helpful because there's only so many ideas and they come around again. And then I think finally, related to this ambitious pragmatism thing I was talking about earlier, there's an element of not fighting what you can't change. You know, when I was at AT&T, I couldn't make Cisco open up their code, but I could make them swallow BGP messages that I crafted for them. Later, we could change the code, but we couldn't change the Broadcom ASIC. Now we can change the ASIC, but it still has to work at line rate. You can't put arbitrary code down there. So I think in each stage, what was able to be changed was a little richer, but it was always still at any given time, there's a set of things that are on the table and another set that are really just not able to be changed yet. And so the flip side of that is to fight on longer time scales to enable the kinds of change you think you need the next go round. So, you know, make the management plane programmable, then start to make the control plane programmable, then start to make the data plane programmable. It's baby steps, and that's okay. But each iteration makes the next level of change not seem crazy.
Sorry, I was muted. So I think that's one of the problems that we actually do have in the network engineering world as well, is that the average network engineer just doesn't think they can change anything. Like, they just think, I'm stuck with whatever the vendor ships me and that's it. And they're not thinking outside the box, partially because they don't know the history, partially because they don't understand how these things work. They know how to configure them, but they don't know how they work, under the hood, and they don't understand like what packet switching looks like and stuff like that. So, this is some place where getting in with a local college, like if you're in the area of Princeton and you want to get involved and help Jen do research, I mean, if you're a network administrator, I'm sure Jen has an email address and you can email her and say,
dinosaur, but with a J.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can just say, hey, I've got this network over here and I'm really interested in what you're talking about. Let's go talk about this and think about it, or go to Hotnets and look at some of the research, or get involved in the ACM. And I think those can actually be vehicles for people.
Yeah. There's a big gap, I think, between network practitioners and networking researchers. I mean, I think there are a lot of efforts. I mean, researchers often go to NANOG. I've done that in the past. I always find it worthwhile. There's things like the IRTF and the Applied Networking Research Workshop and so on. But I think these are much fewer and further between than they should be. And that goes in both directions. And it's not just that the network practitioners don't reach to us. We don't reach to them. And that's been harder for me. When I was at AT&T, I could, go across the hall or at least down the street and talk to people who are running real networks and try to help and learn in the process. And that becomes more difficult when you're a little removed. And that's why I've really enjoyed working with our campus IT staff, because I was trying to reproduce the ability to actually have someone to talk to who has war stories to share.
So good. So Donald, any questions?
I'm muted too. No, the standard question I have is, what would you do different? And I'm not sure that really kind of applies to, because we kind of talked about that a bit here already. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, one thing I still have a lot of regret about is, getting BGP security to be better. And it's not related to what we talked about thus far. But I keep thinking the time's coming and then it never does. So I continue to work on BGP security on the side just because it haunts me. And so that's something I can't quite let go of.
What kind of haunt are we talking about here? I mean, like...
Nightmares.
Wake up at night in cold sweats.
There could be an interception attack any minute, No, but if you think about it, the fragility of the infrastructure that the global economy relies on is remarkably fragile. I mean, it's shocking, actually, to think about how awful it is and how easily it can be attacked or even just fat-fingered. So that's something I don't know that I have a lesson to offer, because if I knew what to do, I would be doing it. Yeah, but I mean, I think we continue to try to figure out what the attacks are. I would say the only lesson I've thought of recently there, and it applies more broadly, is that the internet's much more consolidated than we ever thought it would be. The number of companies is small. The number of hops between content and eyeballs has shrunk a lot because of CDNs and cloud. And so if you think about the number of stakeholders who have to agree to affect change in the internet today, it's a lot less than it used to be. And that's a bane and a boon. Obviously, it's a great thing because if those stakeholders realize their collective power to make the infrastructure we rely on better, that's a great opportunity that you may be able to get a lot done with not too much need to get huge global agreement. On the flip side, of course, that comes with all sorts of robustness and privacy risks because of the extreme consolidation in those companies. So I'm really fascinated to think more about if we knew the internet was going to evolve this way with a small number of companies controlling a huge fraction of the infrastructure, what would we have done differently? Maybe we wouldn't have BGP. I don't know. That would be at least one positive outcome.
Some people listening to this are going to be happy that you said that. Others are going to be horrified.
Yeah.
That's okay.
But something would be different, right? I think we thought it was going to be a much more democratized and flat infrastructure than it's proven to be. And that should have implications for its technical architecture. It's not clear yet what those should be, but you would think it should have implications.
Right. Exactly. Well, Jen, thanks for coming on. This was an awesome going back through the history of programmable networks. We'll get you back on for some other things we want to talk about. And of course, you're always welcome on the Hedge as well. Now, can people follow your work someplace specifically at princeton.edu or something like that?
Yeah, www.cs.princeton.edu/JREX. Okay. Also, if you're interested in the campus work we're doing, we have a website, p4campus.cs.princeton.edu. And I'm JRexNet on Twitter, but I'm not very active there, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm not very active on Twitter either. Great. Awesome. And I'll try to put those in the show notes as well. And Donald is me, not you, sharp on Twitter, I think. Yeah, but you're muted, Donald, so nobody can hear you validating that.
You're right. I'm totally muted. My kids got home. They're running around like crazy kids.
I see. Yeah, there you go. My kids are too old to run around like crazy kids. Well, that's not absolutely true, but okay. I'm Russ White. You can always find me at rule11.tech and here on History of Networking. Thanks very much for listening.